So what I'm going to do today is talk about some of the ideas in this book, Entrepreneurial Economics, Bright Ideas from the Dismal Science. It's edited by myself. It's published by Oxford University Press with the Independent Institute. You can find out after the talk, you can find out more about the book at entrepreneurialeconomics.org or at independent.org, website of the Independent Institute. And of course, it's available at better bookstores everywhere. Well, I could perhaps best explain what the book is all about by telling you a little about Edwin Chadwick. This name may be familiar to a few of you, perhaps from some of Dwight Lee's columns in Ideas on Liberty. If not, Chadwick was a 19th century British lawyer and a self-trained economist. He was a friend to the great utilitarian Jeremy Bentham and also to John Stuart Mill. And Chadwick was very active in all of the political questions of his time, of his day. And one of those questions was what to do about the sorry state of British convicts who were then regularly being transported to Australia. And the conditions on the ships which transported these convicts, I'm just going to let a few more people come in, let them find a chair. We're going to rush from one talk to another pretty quickly. Come on in, four chairs up front, you over here. Okay, thanks. Okay, so Chadwick and the British convicts. So these convicts were regularly being sent to Australia, and the conditions on the ships which transported these convicts were so bad that it was a quite regular occurrence for half or more, sometimes, of these convicts to die en route. And, you know, despite the fact that these were convicts, this was considered a humanitarian issue, especially to the British social classes. This is a thorn in their side. And so a number of commissions were established to look into this problem. And, as commissions are wont to do, they issued all kinds of reports and recommendations. You know, they said, well, you have to carry so much water and so many lemons, you know, the limes, and you got to do this, you got to do that. And they issued all of these decisions, and yet nothing seemed to change. Year after year, these convicts would be sent to Australia, and many thousands of them would die en route. And this is where Chadwick came in. Chadwick began to investigate this issue, and very early on, he found that it was government policy of the time to pay the captains of the ships who were transporting these criminals, to pay them for every convict which got on board the ship. And on realizing this, Chadwick had an inspiration. He knew how to solve the problem. Can any of you tell me? Exactly, exactly. So instead of paying the captains for the number of convicts who got on board the ship, Chadwick recommended that henceforth they pay only for the number of convicts who got off the ship on their own accord in Australia. And indeed, the government instituted this policy, and very quickly after that, the survival rate went up from something like 50% to over 90%. So Chadwick was able to solve this problem. And his remarkable success is one of the inspirations for this book, Entrepreneurial Economics. And the theme of the book is creating new markets and institutions that harness Adam Smith's invisible hand in a simple but effective manner in order to make society better off. Okay. Take advantage of markets, harness the invisible hand, make society better off. That's what the book is all about. And it contains 13 chapters on everything from healthcare to urban transit that illustrate this theme, clever ideas that illustrate this theme. And I'd like to tell you today just about a few of those ideas, about two in particular. Now, the first idea, I imagine that most people here are quite familiar with the virtues of markets, but what I hope to do in the first sort of section is talk about how markets can be used in new ways, not to buy and sell goods per se, but rather to generate information. to understand the logic of what I'm going to call these information markets, it's useful to review just a little bit Hayek's 1945 paper, The Use of Knowledge in Society. And again, I imagine this will be reviewed for a number of you, but it won't take too long. Hayek, in that paper, pointed out that market prices aggregate and communicate information. So consider, suppose that a valuable new use for copper has been discovered. What's going to happen? Well, the new users of copper will begin to bid up the price. And as they do so, this will induce other copper users to begin to substitute. Some copper users will find substitution easy, some more difficult. Plumbers, for example, may begin to switch from copper tubing to plastic tubing. Electricians may continue to use copper in wiring, but they may switch to fiber optics in communications. Okay? And as we do so, this frees up copper for the new uses. Suppliers of copper will be induced to supply more, perhaps by drilling deeper copper mines or by spending more on exploration. Copper scrap will become more valuable, making recycling more economical and more common. And as each copper user and supplier responds to the new prices, a subtle and quite complex process of reallocation occurs, with copper flowing from the less valuable uses to the more valuable uses. And amazingly, this process is spontaneous, that is, it occurs without any central direction, even without anybody's knowledge. And of course, Hayek, as you know, Hayek and Mises argued that this unplanned market process is the only method that can reallocate resources to their economically highest value use. No economic czar could understand, let alone gather or efficiently employ all the information about copper's many uses, the substitutes, the sources, the methods of extraction and distribution, and so forth. And yet, even though no one could encompass all this information, all of the relevant information about copper is indeed out there. But it's out there in the heads of the millions of people who use copper. Through their buying and selling, and their absentation from buying and selling, these millions of people create a single, observable, and useful number, the market price. Without markets, this information in prices, it wouldn't even exist. But when markets are unfettered, and they're open to entry and exit, information can in fact be extracted from prices and used in all kinds of novel ways. For example, this is an example from one of my favorite textbooks, Paul Haynes' The Economic Way of Thinking. Here's how you can use information in prices. Haynes points out that in December of 1991, the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization and the World Watch Institute, they had a joint press conference at which they predicted an increased scarcity of grain, particularly of wheat, coming in the coming year. Now, other than waiting to see what happens, what would be a good way of evaluating this forecast? Look at possible, yeah, you can look at weather, okay, you can weather patterns, what else? You can look at the futures markets, right, you can look for a price. Look at a futures price, that is the price that people set today for a trade in the future. And on the day of the UN forecast, Paul Haynes did exactly this. He looked in the newspaper. It's not like this information is hard to find. He looked in the newspaper and he found that number two hard canvas wheat, which is a standard and major grade of wheat, that on that day it was selling for $4.05 a bushel. The 1992 March futures price, this is in December, the March futures price was $3.87. The May price, $3.64, July, $3.33, September, $3.31, and December, a year in the future, was $3.51. So contrary to the United Nations and to the World Watch Institute, the market price was predicting, if anything, less scarcity of grain in the future. Now, so here we have these two forecasts. In whose forecast would you have more confidence? All right, a harder question. Why? Why? Why, let's suppose we have more confidence in the market price. Why? Right, okay, that's definitely one major reason. If The weak speculators are wrong. They put their money where their mouth is. Okay? They have real incentives to be right, and they face real costs when they're wrong. In addition, the weak speculators and people involved in the wheat market, this is what they do for a living. Okay? They're involved in wheat every day. And each of them has some specialized knowledge. They have some special information. And this wheat market involves thousands and thousands of these traders, each with some specialized knowledge. And so what is created, the price which is created, can be thought of as an informed consensus. Now, economists, in fact, have actually come to rely on this sort of reasoning quite heavily. And they've tested and made use of these theories in a number of interesting ways. Economist Richard Roll, for example, of UCLA, he discovered, I love this, he discovered that the information in the futures prices for orange juice, for oranges in Florida, this could be used to improve the predictions of weather for the National Weather Bureau. One of my favorite papers, written by a political scientist, used stock prices to help understand the power of seniority in Washington. This political scientist, he looked at what happened to the stock price of Boeing on the day that the senior senator from Washington State died unexpectedly of a heart attack. And what he found, that on that day, the price of Boeing stock jumped down really quite unusually. So he was able to conclude, or able to suggest, that having a senator in Washington, the senator was known as the senator from Boeing, really pays off for special interests. And he was able to put a number on how much this was worth to Boeing to have that senator in his pocket. So, in the past 20 years or so, economists have become accustomed to extracting forecasts and other information from raw market data. But even more recently, economists have begun to create markets, specifically in order to generate information. And this is what Chapter 5 of Entrepreneurial Economics, written by Robin Hanson, is all about. The best known of these so-called information or prediction markets is the Iowa political stock market. In the Iowa market, lets traders use real money to buy and sell shares of political candidates. And the way it works is a share in George W. Bush, for example, would pay a dollar if President Bush wins the next election and nothing otherwise. So if the market price for a share of for a Bush share is 75 cents, this suggests that market participants think that President Bush has a 75% chance of winning the next election. Anybody can participate in these markets, by the way. You can go on the web, and you can start buying and selling shares today if you want, if you're not already gambling enough. Now, why would anyone care? Why would anyone care what market participants think about election probabilities? The reason is because in nearly 14 years of experience with predicting U.S. and foreign elections, primaries, and other political events, the Iowa market has proven to be more accurate than polls, than Gallup polls or other polls. Indeed, prices have another advantage. They're available 24 hours a day, and it turns out that these prices, they jump around a lot less than do the polls. The polls are going like this, prices are much more stable. Indeed, the Iowa market have themselves passed the market test, because in tight elections, professional bond traders who often have millions of dollars, sometimes even billions of dollars, are riding on post-election economic policy, they've been known to monitor the Iowa market for clues about what's going to happen. Now, industry has also not been oblivious to the predictive power of markets. Hewlett-Packard, for example, believed that its sales force collectively knew much more, knew quite a bit about how strong hardware sales were going to be in the next 6 months. So they created an information market to try and tap this knowledge. Now, Hewlett-Packard had long tried to get at this knowledge using the standard methods, questionnaires and surveys and so forth. But we believe that if these methods were not adequately conveying the collective thinking of the sales force, and certainly they were not conveying this thinking in a digestible and manager-friendly format, the sales force, they often relied on hunches and intuition, and it's hard to get that into a survey. It's hard to put that down on a questionnaire. So what did HP do? Well, in HP's information market, the employees could buy and sell shares that paid dividends based upon the future sales of one of its products. So for example, a typical security would pay out a dollar if future sales were between, say, 10,000 and 15,000 units. It would pay nothing otherwise. There were 10 of these securities, so there was enough to cover all of the reasonable expectations. So there was a security for sales will be between 10,000 and 15,000 units. There was a security if sales were going to be between 15,000 and 1 and 20,000 units, and so forth. Now, so let's think about what prices in these markets represent. Suppose that you thought that there was a 50% probability that sales were going to be between 10,000 and 15,000 units in the future. What's the most you'd be willing to pay for a security that pays out a dollar if that actually happens, if sales actually are between 10,000 and 15,000 units and you think there's a 50% probability? What are you going to be willing to pay? 50 cents, right. What if you think there's only a 25% probability that this event is going to happen? How much would you then be willing to pay? 25 cents, exactly. Now, think about graphing, if you like, the prices in these markets. Put sales on the x-axis. I don't have an overhead, unfortunately, but put sales on the x-axis. So 5 to 10,000, 10 to 15, 15 to 20, and so forth. Sales are here. Put prices on the y-axis. What are you going to get? You're going to get a curve. Right. You're going to get something like, it could be a bell curve, a normal curve, but you're going to get some distribution. Okay. And using this distribution, HP could really do powerful stuff. They could find, for example, the probability that their sales force put on sales falling anywhere, say, below 10,000 units. Or they could put a probability on the sales force, they could put a probability on the eventuality that sales were anywhere above 25,000 units, or anywhere in between. Okay. So the information from this market was much more nuanced, much more flexible than is available from a questionnaire. Note, by the way, that this distribution, this curve, is itself created by aggregation. No one among the sales force had this distribution in his head. Okay? This is how markets create information from, we gather it together, we aggregate information. Well, question then is, how did it do? Okay? How did this market do? So to test the market, HP compared the forecasts from the market forecast, the average, mean, average, the mean forecast from the market, the average forecast from the market, with their official forecast, which was generated using the old methods, generated using surveys and questionnaires. And what they found is that in 15 out of 16 trials, the mean market prediction was significantly closer to the actual sales figure than was the official prediction. And in the one remaining case, the mean market prediction and the official prediction were equally close. So encouraged by these results, HP in fact has created its own experimental laboratory. You can see how markets are being used internally to a firm. This is not about buying and selling, it's about generating information, using the marvelous powers of markets to aggregate and communicate information in really entirely new ways. Another example of this, an interesting one, is the Hollywood Stock Exchange. This is on the web, some of you may play there. What the Hollywood Stock Exchange does is it lets traders buy and sell shares and options in movies, in music, in Oscar contenders. And trading on this market is conducted in Hollywood dollars, fake dollars, not real money. But it seems that the lack of real money has not discouraged some 800,000 people from participating in this market. And what they do, they trade for fun, And what they do is they try and guess which movies are going to be successful, which ones are going to generate future sales. And dividends on their shares are based upon actual sales figures. Now, this is fun for the traders. Okay? It's kind of an interesting game. But the purpose of the Hollywood Stock Exchange is to make money. Okay? And the way they make money is they gather this information from their traders, and they've been selling that information to movie studios who are trying to get a better grasp of which films are going to be successful and which are not. And indeed, studies of this market have shown that it does predict very well, even though it's not, even though it's sort of fake money. It's interesting. But they predict very well actual sales figures. In the book, in Entrepreneurial Economics, economist Robin Hanson of George Mason University explains an even further broadening of this idea. He suggests that information markets could be used to predict election results. He suggests that information markets could be used to answer questions of public policy. So, instead of using markets to predict election results or box office receipts, these markets, which would be open to everyone, would predict the results of new legislation. So information markets could potentially offer much more accurate predictions about the effects of controversial legislation, such as free trade pacts or handgun right to carry laws, than we get today from pundits and from politicians. Indeed, if markets showed the same accuracy in judging political issues that they've shown in other areas, voters might even begin to rely on these markets to cast their votes, to guide their votes. And in time, political information markets could replace the less accurate information gathering mechanisms that we use to make political decisions today. So, I think that everyone here knows that markets are an important institution of a well-run society. But until recently, few people thought of markets as something that might be used internally to run a business or to help answer an important question. And yet, the very virtues that Mises and Hayek pointed out, the uncanny ability of markets to usefully aggregate and quantify large amounts of dispersed information, information which is out there in the heads of millions of people, this virtue which Hayek and Mises first pointed out in the 20s, it also applies to information markets. And these information markets can be used for everything from the prediction of election returns and the weather, to the forecasting of uncertain consumer preferences. And in the future, we might even rely on the information processing power of markets to help us decide some of these contentious political questions. Okay. That's the first idea in entrepreneurial economics that I want to talk about. And I want to take questions. I'll do that at the end, but please feel free to ask questions about anything I've talked about. But I want to talk about another idea in the book, kind of to give you an idea, as I said, what the book is really all about. And this is a more, perhaps a more familiar political context. As many of you know, every year, thousands of people die while waiting for an organ transplant. There are now some 80,000 people on a waiting list to get a organ. And it's estimated that half of these people will die while they're waiting to get a new organ. And as with the problem that Chadwick dealt with, every year there's reports, there's commissions, there's studies, and yet every year this problem seems to go on and on and on, seems to be unsolvable. You get spokespeople like Michael Jordan trying to get people to sign their organ donor card, and yet thousands and thousands of people die every year because organs are not available. And in fact, the problem is actually getting worse. Because medical progress is expanding the number of people who could benefit from an organ, while the supply of organs is actually remaining flat or even falling. There are two papers in Entrepreneurial Economics which deal with this terrible tragedy. First idea many of you are probably familiar with. Why is there a shortage? Why is there a shortage of organs? What's the explanation for a shortage? A little incentive, okay. Even more generally, it's a price control, right? Okay. You're not allowed
It is currently illegal to buy and sell an organ. The price is controlled at zero. And what do we know? We know rent controls create a shortage of apartments. Controls on gasoline, such as we had in the 1970s, they created long lineups for gasoline, a shortage of gasoline. Similarly, a price control on organs, a price set at zero, means the demand is going to exceed the supply. It's exactly the same. Indeed, this analysis of the organ shortage is actually so common among economists that some textbooks use the organ shortage as an illustration of price controls more generally. You know, it used to be the illustration was, the gasoline crisis, right? But of course, students today, they don't remember that. They have no idea what you're talking about. You ever line up? They don't know. So the modern example is the organ shortage. Now, the first paper in entrepreneurial economics suggests that we remove government controls on the buying and selling of organs. Perhaps even allow a futures market in organs. So in which I could sell the right to my organ today in the event that I die unexpectedly when my organ is still useful. Hope that doesn't happen, especially hope my liver is not useful. I'm trying to try and make use of it as much as possible. Now this idea has been discussed by economists for some time, and in fact, one Nobel Prize winner, Gary Becker, has endorsed this idea publicly. And the paper in Entrepreneurial Economics that I recommend highly, it does a very good job at explaining this proposal and dealing with objections. And indeed, this is a very interesting time to be discussing this because it seems like we are making a little bit of progress on this issue. At its recent meeting in December of 2001, the American Medical Association debated a proposal to remove their objections to the concept of offering payments to organ donors or to their surviving family members. The proposal at that time was tabled, but they're going to bring it up again in the next meeting, which is in June, which is next month. And it may pass. Similarly, in fact, earlier this week, the American Society of Transplant Surgeons also endorsed a plan to remove the objection. They no longer object to at least offering to recoup, to compensate organ donors for funeral expenses, the families of organ donors for funeral expenses. So it's an interesting time. It seems we are making a little bit of progress. This is also going to be brought up at the International Meeting of Transplant Surgeons in Miami in September. However, I don't think it's going to happen. Right? I think it's unlikely. You know, it's hard enough to convince politicians to support laissez-faire in steel, let alone in the market for human organs. We can't convince them about steel. It's going to be a hard sell. Right? And like it or not, many people do find the idea of buying or selling a human organ to be morally repugnant. Now, libertarians and others, we may try to convince others of the virtues of markets, even in this case. But it's also our responsibility to take into account people's moral convictions when we try and design new institutions. This brings me to the second paper in Entrepreneurial Economics on organ markets. The second paper, which is written by myself, suggests another way of understanding this problem. What I suggest is that the problem of organ shortages, not necessarily a price control problem, but is rather a tragedy of the commons. The tragedy of the commons is the tendency for any resource which is owned in common to become overused, understocked, and worn out. If fishing rights, for example, are owned in common, there's a tendency for overfishing and even for complete depletion of the fishery. And the reason is that when fishing rights are held in common, an individual fisherman gains nothing by restricting his catch. All that happens is he makes it easier for others to catch more fish. And what's wrong with the current policy on human organs is that available organs are treated exactly like a commons. UNOS, the United Network for Organ Sharing, in fact, is rather proud of this. They say that transplantable human organs are, quote, a national resource, national resource, a collective resource. So any citizen who meets certain conditions is allowed access to this national resource, regardless of whether or not they contributed to the upkeep. Organs, they're treated just like fish in a lake, which is owned in common. And thus we have an organ shortage for the same reasons that we have overfishing. There's little reason to give when anyone can take. Now, what's the solution to a tragedy of the commons problem? What's the solution to these sorts of problems? Privatization, right. Property rights, okay? Enclosure, property rights. When a lake, for example, is owned privately, the owner knows that if he restricts his catch today, more will be available for him. I think to a large extent. But the second and more important virtue is that by making getting an organ be conditional on being willing to give up an organ, we will greatly expand the supply of organs and will alleviate the crisis. In other words, if the only way to get an organ is through a previously signed an organ donor card, then many more people will sign their organ donor cards and the shortage will be alleviated. Now, there's plenty more details on implementation can be discussed or are discussed in the book. And also, I'd be happy to take, I'm sure a number of you have questions, I'll be happy to take those in just a minute. Let me conclude. Let me conclude with this thought. We have a lot of marketeers and P.T. Barnum types in politics, but not very many true entrepreneurs. Not many people who think carefully and deeply about institutions and incentives who build products of lasting value. We all know about the great role of the entrepreneur in the American economy, but we also need entrepreneurs in public policy, and this is what entrepreneurial economics is all about. So thank you.